We're going to talk about the Enron email corpus. It's a great honor to be here at HOPE. And the title of the talk is Where the Bodies Are Buried. There are two types of bodies in this talk. The first one, of course, is an email body. And there's about 250,000 of those. And then there are actually two real bodies. And we're going to try and walk through the detective story behind this particular case. So we have, let me go back one. So what you see here on the left is the mosaic of 5,000 attached photos that were travel around today in Enron email corpus. And this mosaic, as you can see, is probably 40% white, meaning these are relevant corporate documents. And about the 20 to 30% of them that you see are colorful are, in fact, very personal photos that are attached to folders of Enron employees. So we're going to do three primary tasks here. First, we're going to fire all the lawyers. And this relates to a case that Enron was prosecuted for. Basically, Texas hacked California's electrical grid. And this led to a massive sort of both political and power crisis in California. And we're going to take a subset of the emails that were submitted for the court case, submit that through machine learning, modern machine learning, 15 years later, and see if we can automate what was given to the legal interns at the time. So this is a project called Predictive Coding, and it's all over many legal cases simply because what was big in 2002 is much, much bigger in 2018. The second is we're going to try and find the fraudulent activity before as it happens in email. So we're not strictly going to do pre-crime minority report, but we're going to try and anticipate, could you, with modern tools, actually see the unwinding of this company? And the third project is we're going to ask why. And I choose that partly because Enron was famous for using this phrase in their ads. They were considered one of the most six years running, the most innovative company in America. And that was their motto, like Apples Think Different, was ask why. Now, in this case, ask why is a little more confrontational because Enron's email is the largest public email database, corpus. And as many people realize, email is a two-way conversation. So the fact that we rake in 150 executives' emails, we're actually raking in a lot of to and froms there. And we're going to go through some history of how that came to be public. So we'll say the average age in this room may be 30, so you were somewhere in middle school. I definitely was not in middle school. I was past that. But so we're going to get in a little time capsule here and revisit what it was like in 2002. So it was year 13 in The Simpsons, only 17 more years to go. And the first thing you notice is the internet came on a CD, AOL. And the second thing is phones really were run by a Finnish company, Nokia, and they actually were mainly used for phones, for taking calls. What you see over here on the left is a word cloud of all the public, all the personal email domains of all the Enron employees captured. So this gives you a view of sort of who was big then, AOL.com, now owned by Verizon, Yahoo.com, now owned by Verizon, Hotmail, Office 365, and then we finally have Earthlink in here somewhere, which is a conglomerate between Windstreams and some people say Church of Scientology. But anyway, the point is, this is who, if I were sending a marriage announcement, a birthday, good wishing, I may send it from my Enron.com to any of these. The number one show was ER. Over here to the other side, you have an employee who in 1999 says, my job is so crazy, it's exactly like you're watching ER without all the blood. Now, the interesting thing about this is ER exists today in the form, not in terms of a TV show, but in terms of Enron Oil and Gas Resources. It's really the biggest remaining arm of Enron after it declared bankruptcy. Turns out that's the world's largest natural gas fracker now. So ER still exists long after the TV show. Because we're talking about machine versus computer, about a mile from here at Equitable Center, in 1997 you had IBM Deep Blue take on Garry Kasparov. And even though Deep Blue was not machine learning, it was really brute force chess, It really was sort of a remarkable event in terms of a tournament event that computer won, human zero. We're going to run up that tally on the computer side. The last thing that puts us in the time capsule is we had the closest U.S. election looming, and we have some Enron commentary here that probably we're not the greatest advocate for our guy from Texas. A side note here, though, is 537 people in Florida will decide this election. Turns out 10% of the voting population in Florida held Enron stock, mainly through a pension fund, so these are teachers, firemen, et cetera. And they became the largest shareholder of Enron, as it was at $95. And they had a strategy that we will buy more at 48, more and more at 22, and finally, when it was a dollar, all of those Florida pensioners lost their money. It turned out the third member of that pension fund was the brother of the guy who won. So that's where we are. We're in our time capsule, the time period 1998 to 2002. So, at this time, Enron was a big deal. I mean, this was the sixth largest company. It would be equivalent today, as it eventually reaches its demise, it's equivalent today of losing Microsoft or losing Facebook. And it really happened between August and December of 2001. So 9/11 comes, and by December 2nd, they're bankrupt. The odd thing is, Fortune magazine really listed them as the most innovative company for 6 years running. Eventually, Enron 2.0, the founder gets six counts of fraud. But they had the second, for years running, they had the second most talented staff. They had the highest quality management. They were a top 25 place to work, and they were the world's largest energy trader. So what did they do? And I think now we're sort of getting into where the corpus will lie. Their business model was to diversify, and they had an asset-light model. Many of you may know the notion of we'll sell anything, but we'll buy nothing. So the idea is that they were traders. So they traded natural gas, they traded electricity. As it became more and more just about paper transactions, they traded weather in the form of weather derivatives or insurance. They traded carbon emissions. They were a huge advocate of climate agreements because they thought this is going to change everything we do because suddenly we can start just trading CO2. They also had a very big broadband division, which was one of the real downfalls because very capital intensive. And honestly, they started running out of cash. The kind of climax of that, when you know you're jumping the shark in this particular business model, is they roll out a huge deal with video maker video distributor Blockbuster. So Enron Blockbuster will become an issue later on. And so who were the cast of characters? I won't really get into them. There were 20 who were eventually convicted or pled guilty. This one, particularly Andrew Fastow, was the chief financial officer, and he now lectures to business schools, hedge funds, on business ethics, things that go wrong. He does introduce himself truthfully as, "I was chief loophole officer at Enron." Classically, they eventually got him to plead guilty and testify because they went after his wife, who also was an early person to be brought into the court case. I will say this litigation continues to go on. As late as December 2015, Jeff Skilling, who was CEO and took a big part of the fall, was still petitioning the Securities Exchange Commission, "When I get out of prison," which is actually 6 months from now, "I still want to sit on public boards," and SEC finally said no. So that's where we are. It's very easy at this point to sort of dismiss Enron. We don't do that sort of stuff anymore. And it's also easy to villainize them, and I just want to present a counterpoint here. Enron was an early advocate of climate agreements. The Kyoto Climate Agreement, they lobbied like mad for. They also really led the natural gas boom, which is really, in many cases, the best chance to displace coal early. You can make an argument you would not have had Governor Schwarzenegger in California, you would not have had Texas Governor Bush, and finally, you would not have had a Death Star, which is why I included it this way. And Death Star in this context will mean a trading strategy to knock out California's electrical grid. So here we are at the corpus, 2.2 terabytes, seemed like a lot in 2001. Now it's probably average Google Drive. So you've essentially taken an entire corporation, 20,000 employees, and you're it. So in essence, you have to you have to go out and search your email for stuff that might look suspicious. When they rolled up Enron in a digital sense, it was 151 senior executives. There is an obvious reason they went after the executives, and we'll elaborate on on that. Various accounts of the full number, 1.7 million, a huge amount of this is spam, a huge amount of this is people forwarding dumb joke threads. So there's actually probably 500,000 messages, which eventually get whittled down to about 220,000 messages. If you were to print it, it's a quarter million pages, so don't print it. It's about $20,000 to print. I became interested in this number when people talked about printing Wikipedia. And it would take you 2.7 years to read this. So some sympathy for the legal interns who tried. So around February 2002, so now we're like 3 months after they've declared bankruptcy, the FBI came in and said, freeze. You know, we're going to preserve all your electronic documents. Don't destroy anything. And these are actually the boxes at Houston FBI headquarters, or the field office. And the charge was led by Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is part of the Department of Energy. And they were really responsible for regulating both the grid and natural gas. So let's try and build a better machine. There's an interesting New Yorker article in 2017 I'd really recommend, but it says Enron email corpus is where everyone exercises their machine learning. Everyone exercises so many PhD theses built on this. It's actually a text nobody's read. There's no one who has read this as a book. So we can try and be the first one, but I kind of doubt we'll get there. An interesting side note here is there's an R project in 2016 called The Good Life, and you would sign up, and you would say, I agree to receive 49 emails a day for the next 28 years. So basically, and their argument is you're going to relive the demise, the slow, nightmarish demise of this piece by piece. I will say, I think people have heard various stories here, but there are 4,000 research papers, academic research papers, 135 in just this year. So broadly speaking, 10,000 academic authors, graduate students, legal interns. So what can we possibly say new about it? And that's really the point of this talk and why I think it might be of interest to Hope. So I won't belabor too much about machine learning. There's just fantastic online resources for this. I will talk in a cheat sheet sort of way. On the far left, you see a decision tree, and this is most familiar to programmers. It's basically an if-then tree. Most, video games are built on this. There's a variant that will show up a few times called random forest, which is basically a decision tree multiplied by 50 subsets. And all of those decision trees will eventually vote. And the idea is to break the fragility of a decision tree. In other words, decision trees don't respond well to new data they haven't seen before. The middle part I'll skip over, and the far left we'll talk about neural nets, and this you just can't escape it in machine learning. Largely since about 2012, when it just started taking over image and audio and text to speech. It turns out it's a terrible algorithm for this problem, and largely because there's just not an internet size of data. It's 220,000 emails, and so it tends to not perform well. So here's the problem with Enron. It has all the components you would expect. So we will build a data set, which will have dates, and we'll have a chronology. And you immediately encounter why email is so messy. Not only are we going to do unstructured text, but the way it's distributed these days is distributed everywhere. We're going to draw on the 2004 USC version, which has been cleaned again in 2016. But basically, it's organized as if you had the original stack of 200 CDs, which is really how this thing was moved around. And so it's Outlook, and Outlook binaries dumped to folders labeled by people. So we're going to break all that structure and basically sort it by date so we can say, well, this is what was happening on 9/11 in Enron, or this is what was happening when they were raided by the FBI. The interesting part, of course, with email is some of these people have, we were interested in tracking the people, and so some of these people have, you know, seven aliases, and Enron had a creepy thing of Ken.lay at Enron. So a lot of this stuff, it becomes a hard task to make it pinned to a person. The way machine learning usually works is I have a favorite flavor and you give me a new problem and I spin up my black box. We're gonna take a little bit different approach. We're gonna just throw the whole world of training algorithms against this. It's actually more like thousands, but really we're going to talk about 16 major families, and we're going to try and present this as accuracy on one axis and time of execution. Some are slow, you don't want to be slow and inaccurate. Finally, a topic that's very important in this area is how do you tell someone my algorithm works? And this is called some explainable AI. So we're going to try where we can to extract human explainable rules. How do you know you're emulating what the lawyers were really thinking? So here we are at task one. We're going to fire some lawyers. I put the Terminator here because there is a debate about AI taking all our jobs, and it certainly gave him a job in the sense that California in 2000 deregulated electrical grid, and Enron was in on the beginning of it, and they loved to push electricity around. You couldn't store it. You didn't have a Tesla battery, so you got to keep it moving. And so you could move it across borders to Utah, sell it back to California. You could move it to Nevada and move it back. And there were little pinch points where Enron knew you would get a congestion fee. And so they would start shooting against the congestion fee and collect for basically issuing paper orders. So this is our task, and if this will play, now that we're fully ensconced, Sam, this is an Enron ad from 1999.
I can't see what's going on. I don't know what the market price is. The way they used to deal with it, you needed something and you needed it now. It could take you hours, days.
When did the price change?
What is the real price?
What is the real price?
The price was hidden, and it took an incredible amount of work to dig it out. Enron Online will change the markets for many, many commodities. It is creating an open, transparent marketplace that replaces the dark, blind system that existed. It is real simple. You turn on your computer, and it's right there. And if you want to do business, you push the button. So that's our vision. We're trying to change the world.
I love the ask why at the end, and I also love the fact that's like a normal day in New York. But anyway, the point of it is, it's kind of, they have a kind of overshadowing, like the famous Apple 1984, like something creepy's going on, you should ask why, and that's Jeff Skilling. So the court case is Texas is going to really try and jam up California's grid. And they have a lot of different strategies. They all took movies at the time. They had one called Get Shorty. They had one called Death Star. They had one called Fat Boy. Each one of these techniques is kind of trading 101, you know, buy high, buy low, sell high, whatever. But they had basically a manipulation of demand here. The interesting thing to not get too arrogant is Enron founder Ken Lace on the phone to a guy in California, and he says, you guys can do whatever crazy things you people in California do, but we're smarter than you. So the first thing we're gonna do is, we're an intern, we've just been dumped 220,000 emails, and we're gonna start building decision trees. So if you imagine this, like you're searching your Google Drive and you're looking for some particular document you sent, you start with single keywords, that fails. That actually was an entire MIT master's thesis someone wrote. Boolean search kind of fails. If you look for fraud and accounting, you're not going to find it in here. And then you naturally will build up more complex searches, so that's kind of a decision tree. So what you see on the right is the four orange buckets at the bottom. are, this is an email that's relevant to the court case. The gray ones say no. So we're going to start at the top, and we're going to say if it included California, if it included demand, if it included system, and if it included bid, it's likely irrelevant to this court case. And then there's another branch which says if it includes California, gas, and Jeff, it also is relevant. Now, this is a bootstrap technique, so the idea is given 220,000 emails, I will hand score 851. So you use like early crowdsourcing, Crowdflower, you can do this. But the basic idea is from 851, I'm going to generalize to 10,000. I'm going to use those 10,000 for my training set, and then I'm going to generalize to 220,000. So let's make this explainable. In fact, in 7 lines of code, we can capture 75% of what the interns captured and actually submitted to the court case. So this is really, you could write this in any language you like. When when you speak about California.
That's cool to me.
So if you talk about bid or if you talk about gas, it's worth submitting. So these are the ways you would build from a decision tree. Now, clearly, you're not going to win any data competitions with 75% right. It still is remarkably simple, and I like it. So now the promised, we're going to throw some human knowledge. We're not going to of AI here. We're not going to do the whole 51 on this. But what I showed you down here at the in the corner left, you're looking at accuracy versus time. This labeled card is the one tree decision tree. So it gets in the 80, 75% range, and it's very fast. If you go up here, we also have some neural nets, and we get up to random forest. Turns out, you know, with kind of like your average data science project, you can get 95% plus 99% of what the legal interns did. And this becomes more relevant as you and I produce more data. If you wanted to sue some ISP or something, they might have discovery on your drive, and you would actually find out no lawyer will take it because so many interns have to go through your stuff to determine what's discovery. So this is what a random forest looks like, a little bit more complicated than our single decision tree. This is actually one of 50 of these. So this is kind of the mind map, if you will, of what the interns are doing. And it starts at state, and then you would branch to market, and then you would march to implement. And finally, you get down here to all the surrounding orange buckets are zeros in this case, meaning non-responsive. The blue little tabs are responsive. So you could program this. It's very easy to dump into a bunch of if-then statements, and then you can implement it, and then you can start running these like mad. The cool feature of random forest, and this will close out our first task, is they can tell you why they made the decision, or at least like our simple 7 lines of code can do 75% of this job. They will tell you if to capture the data that the interns implicitly captured, if you had price and transmission in California, those are it. The interesting part to me is also, it's kind of more interesting than the percent right, is what's not important here. And you go down here, power is number 2. The one I like is the third lowest is please. So you're pretty sure if somebody asked please in an email, they were really not going to be part of the responsive court cases. So now we're going to get to the pre-crime part. Now, I'm not a big fan of pre-crime. I think it's an interesting thing in terms of machine learning. But you have to admit, very honestly, we are way post-crime. I mean, this is a cold case, if there ever was a cold case. They rolled up all the executives. So if you know anything about the executives, you're not predicting anything. But there are some interesting tools that I think can be exposed by this notion of a machine precog. So let's play another ad, which is a little more aggressive. And I think the point I want to make with this is they say ask why is a confrontational why.
It is a small word, but it is a quick,
sharp approach,
an abrupt word.
Why?
It is the chosen word of the nonconformist, the defiant, and the visionary. It is a
a confrontational word.
Why?
It challenges what's thought to be impossible. If you are not afraid to ask
why?
You can change whatever it is you want.
So what have we learned in 15 years to ask why? You know, really because of Twitter, there's so much sentiment analysis. Because of Facebook, there's so much social network analysis. The first thing you can do is, which very few people have done, everyone does social network. They love to say, this is the influencer and Enron. But very few people have really just say, I'm going to submit their email to some sentiment analysis. I'll show you later. We'll do it with IBM. But you get back three interesting buckets. The first off, so this is sort of the email and how who's similar, who writes like they do. Turns out Ken Lay is in this whole realm all by himself. He's the boss, or at least the founder. Then we have a lot of middle group called the bean counters, and this is really the first group I went through because this is a lot of the bad guys in this particular problem. And it's very boring reading, honestly. And then the far right, the far left, or your right, are the day traders. And these are the really colorful guys. I mean, they will say anything to anybody with no fear of ever getting fired. So turns out IBM went on to win Jeopardy against a human. And they have a very interesting sentiment that they market through IBM Watson called Personality Insight. So I was, let's poke some emails through it. So you just upload about 2,500 words, that's about 10 pages, and it comes back pretty good. I mean, there's probably a horoscope effect here, it says it, so you paste it on that person. But Ken Lay was the son of a Baptist preacher. He was very, very fond of his values and integrity. In some sense, the least well-equipped to defend the company, because he just never had thought of himself in the terms that he was described. The middle guy is a CFO. He's actually, in some sense, because he pled guilty, he's been the most sort of apologetic, but he does say, I was extremely greedy, but his basic IBM at the top, what you're reading here, is what IBM says his personality based on his writing. And here he says, you know, we should all take care of our own business, leave me alone. And the interesting one is Jeff Skilling on the right. He was the CEO for a while. He was the one who really went down with the ship but refused to believe it was sinking. And his writings say he was in it really for the prestige. And that kind of works when you go through the emails. So here's our pre-crime formula. We're going to run through decision tree again. This time it's going to be this is a really hard problem. And we actually capture it by blending with financial data. So this is where I'm saying we're way post-crime and no way using anything magic here. But if you were an executive, you were likely part of this roll-up. If you were bonused, you really benefited and probably had a pretty good foot in the door. Oddly enough, if you did not send many emails, you were in the C-suite. In other words, you were already talking. You just didn't send much email. You're likely going to get rolled up. The third part of this particular formula for decision trees is if you have some anger, right, in the email by sentiment analysis, you're likely a person of interest. And so that's, anyone can code that. You can run all 225,000 and see who got away. Now we're going to look at the reasons that it finds. And the most interesting to me are, again, some of the least predictive, but as I say, pretty good guess. Executive got a bonus, didn't send a lot of emails. In this case, this is a random forest. Fear, there was some fear and anger in those emails. The least predictive is I'm deceiving. And you can take it as part of maybe they were smart enough, not the smartest guys in the room, but they were smart enough to not write it down. And really, Enron collapsed because everything they had built was hinged on the stock value. And once sentiment left the stock value, the company collapsed. But in this case, stock value is least predictive of whether you were rolled up. In other words, if you talked about stock, you probably didn't have it. So this is the whole sum total of AI that you can build as libraries. This is 51 that actually will converge on this problem. And again, you don't want to be down here in the low in your lower right of taking a long time and being inaccurate. There are only three. You want to be up here in the upper, up this side. And our decision tree, again, is very fast, simple decision tree. Our four rules are very fast, and they're down here in the corner. And up at the top, you see random forest. I'm not advocating for random forest. It just happens to work in this case. And all the way out to the right, you see auto-encoded deep neural net. So it's down here in the not accurate, takes a long time. No thank you, Google, on this particular problem. So that's our second task. We can kind of tease out executives did some bad things. Our third task, and this is what really gnawed at me in going through this task, is 99.83% of the company, it was a job. I mean, they had kids, they had to do all kinds of stuff, and they're really taken into this when somebody decides it's a good idea to post it all on the internet. So this is the actual court order that says we will release this into the wild. It's in the public interest to make it a big research project. So now we're, you know, about a year and a couple months after bankruptcy. So one of the curious things is you could be rolled up in this after you were laid off, which kind of makes it super bitter. But anyway, the statement they made was there's a public right to disclosure which outweighs individual right to privacy. And I don't really want to simplify this too much because there is a right to disclosure, and the fact that it sits on 200 CDs in some archive doesn't really help anybody to learn from the mistake. But there is a mistake in terms of just imagining it as a one-way conversation. Maybe it's easier if you know they did something terrible. It's not if they just wrote to someone terrible. And you know, I have down here a short regular expression that could clarify some of this. So Enron did everything. This is where it gets just so mind-blowing because it's a legal case, there kind of was a precedent. You're the defendant. If you think there's something offensive in here, you tell us what to take out. But this time, Enron had 20% of their staff. They had one IT guy. It's like a huge circular monstrosity in Houston, and it's empty. And one IT guy, so they give it as an internally crowdsourced project. Here's 100 people at Enron, you're the last stragglers. Read your boss's email and tell us what's private, right? And what can go wrong? So you know you're a sinking ship because they incentivize people who've read the most emails. So I can click, 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 wow, I'm done, click. And they give you t-shirts if you were the top, or they gave you baseball tickets to clean out your boss's email box. And the grand prize was a day off. So that's to me the real jump in the shark moment. So Duke Law did a study in 2016, and they said there's 10,000 pieces of personally identifying information in here that circulates when it's distributed. And there's kind of this horrible rank list of things that can go wrong. So security numbers, credit card numbers, passwords. These days, phone numbers, birth dates. I mean, how common is it in a corporation to come out and say, happy birthday? Well, it turns out that becomes a potentially PII. So I did the same thing. I found 50,000 in here. And there's all kinds of tricks to do it, but basically this is regular expressions, this is grep, this is all the things that you would normally throw at this kind of problem. And these are kind of the tallies. There are at least four social security numbers still circulating. If you're willing to break all the attachments to text, and I'll show some of the tools, you can get 31 more unique. So basically out of 151 executive emails, at least a fifth of them, their life is breached. It's kind of just a horrible outcome. And it just doesn't make sense. They actually told the people who are searching it, just like you're on Google, type in social security number, and if somebody wrote that, social security number in English, we'll strip it. They didn't try 3 digits, 2 digits, 4 digits. So there are common reasons for such spillage. In 2002, if you joined the Enron Cycling Club, you had to give your social security number and you had to email it. it's kind of bizarre. If you were terminated, you had to give your email, your social security number. Here's a twofer. This is a HIPAA violation. This person is taking these prescriptions, and she's got to have her social security number, and it's all got to go on Enron's logo. Here's the seven OPSEC crimes you can commit. Don't send your resume from an Enron to another company from an Enron address. Don't send your social security number. Don't send your date of birth. Because I'm applying for another job, I have to get my transcript, which requires a credit card, and I'm going to send it my AOL account too. The real thing about the seven crimes here is he's applying to be an intelligence analyst from Enron. So there are all kinds of credit cards in here that are not worth going into, except I like the sort of human color of I'm in a real hurry here. And the other one is, don't take me for a fool. I'm not getting in your vacation plans. Here's my credit card. And here's the actual balance for your nice cabin. There are password tricks in here. There's lots of sports fantasy leagues. They have password resets, Neiman Marcus, a lot of online shopping in an office. At this time, a GET request on a URL will deliver back both password and username and the URL. People who knew better, like developers, were trading source code, and this is an R function that gives you their Oracle database password. I pretty much assume it's not user password because nobody does that. But anyway, the one thing that, as I pointed out in task two, the one thing that's so telling in this is if you've got a bonus. So there is an Excel that has everyone's bonus in it. And somebody at Enron thought, this could be terrible. We don't want everyone to know the bonuses, so let's give it a password. So you open this Excel, and it says, well, what's your password? And you can type anything in here. And it says, no, that's not right. You just want read only. And then it spills out everyone's guts. So to me, curiously enough, you can rewrite history here. This is the press release when Video Blockbuster wanted to use Enron's broadband trading. They wrote a press release, and the first thing Enron did, and you basically turn on view history on this Word document, and they said, wait a minute, Enron's not second. It's Enron and Blockbuster, not Blockbuster and Enron. And the second one is, which I really like, is Enron says, the original one was we're gonna give reliable, secure video streaming, and Enron says, whoa, we're not reliable. So that's everything we could, kind of tease out here. There's so much we'll never know. And in some sense, there was shredding going all along. Enron, here's a lawyer saying it was a subject Dark Star, in which he says, we're in litigation with American Coal, therefore Dark Star. And any claim that we've misused or abused, please send all that information to me and I'll take care of it. But really, it was the thing that took it down was the auditors themselves started shredding. But the way they started shredding was so interesting. The guy in charge says in court, I instructed all my people to follow the document retention policy. And this was code for if it's older than 6 months, shred it. And so that was sort of the dog whistle that went out to everyone, and they shredded everything. So my talk couldn't be complete without a short demo. So this is, we're going to de-shred some Enron documents. You see upper left is a Christmas party, and at one point Enron had a Christmas party in actually Houston Astros baseball stadium. It was a big deal. And in 170 lines of code, we're gonna unshred this. And so because this is a strip cut, it's actually not that hard of a problem, and that's why you can do it in 170 lines. But basically, we're gonna compare pixel values on the edge, and it turns out that will reassemble Jeff Skilling on Santa's lap, if I can. So this is it. It just ran. Okay. So, you're welcome. So this is actually a fascinating problem. If you ever saw the movie Argo, the CIA is trapped in Iranian embassy. They got to get out. CIA starts shredding all the documents. And in the movie, I don't know if this is true, but they got a bunch of Iran got a lot of Persian carpet weavers who knew how to patch things together, and they unshredded it. Instagram had an engineering challenge in 2012, and I think, you know, shredders now have very tight specs, so strip cut would never cut it. So there's a human component to this. I don't really want to be flippant about it, and it kind of draws to, there are three rules of apology. You know, I did something wrong to you, I really feel bad about doing something wrong to you, and how can I make it better? And we never really got that. Here is a pregnant woman on the day she's fired, and there's Ken Lay being taken off to court. But in 2010, they asked Jeff Skilling in prison, they said, what would you do differently? And he said, three things, no question. One, I would have pled the fifth. Actually, Ken Lay did plead the fifth. Two, I would have hired a media person immediately to tell our story. And third, I would never have been sarcastic. I mean, really, you've already been there. And the sarcasm at one point was, he said, they're on to us, which, you know, probably not a great way. And he says, well, it's sarcastic. So Enron was not blind to what they were doing. This is 3 days after, this is August 2001. So 3 days after Skilling resigns, his chief of staff writes to him and says, these are our ills. We used aggressive accounting, we did black box reporting, meaning we didn't really have a business or couldn't explain it. We overhyped the stock, but the part that's really bad is we had a mercenary culture. And then the part that you just can't send that to the boss without saying, but I love being here. So there was a point at which it gets surreal, and this is that 3 days after they take over. And so he's going to go, this is the first employee meeting after the CEO has resigned. And everybody kind of knows something's up.
Good morning.
So. I like this guy over here. He's like, why are we standing up? Why? Ask why. I will say, over here in the corner, you see
him. Well, I didn't expect that.
Okay. No, I didn't either. So over here in the left corner, you see two familiar characters. That's Mueller and Comey, who actually were the people who prosecuted the FBI, Jeff Skilling. So that same sort of mea culpa goes back between Ken Lay and the chief of staff says, it really is that we have people on staff who are rewarded to have little or no respect for anyone. But I still hope I love this place. So the comedy is there are dedicated employees spill their guts. Here's one who, this is about a month before they declare bankruptcy, and he says, there's still hope. Let's the employees do a fundraiser. Okay, this is a $74 billion company at one point. Like, took it to bake sale. The good part is down here at the bottom, Ken Lay says, I agree, but we've decided to merge with Dynergy for a variety of reasons. The other one, which really is heartbreaking, is dedicated employee. This is 3 days before they'll declare bankruptcy. And he says, I've been an employee for 21 years. You have my vote of confidence. Over here, he says, when Donald Trump was bankrupt, he got the brightest minds together and he rebuilt himself. We can do it too. And then finally, he comes back, this dedicated employee, and says, and I've given you my last $10,000 just to show in my 401k. So that really became $1. So in conclusion, we have the largest public domain email repository. We found 50,000 PII elements, which really should be redacted. We've automated some of the legal interns. This is by no means novel. It is a big topic, and predictive coding is a big deal. And we found sort of the persons of interest. I'm not real proud of the fact that it's precog because it's very postcog. But the interesting part is what's the reason behind it. So there are some actual real problems buried in here. I think you could build some modern deep privacy filters. There are real fraud cases, that fraud filters that run through currently SEC filings that are quite interesting, and as I say, predictive coding. So these are this is the tool belt. Turns out you don't need a lot of Hadoop here. It's not that big. Perl, Python, R, Java. If you really are interested in the attachments, you want to be able to split all that to text. So on that, I will conclude. Thank you.